How do I put it? He's very interested in things that are beneath the surface. So I guess if he does a portrait of someone, then he's looking not just to represent how they look, but also who they are. And I think a lot of the portraits are really him, even though he's doing someone else, but they're about him. And I think that in a way, that's what it's like, what I think of as it being to be a musician, because I'm looking at the music and I'm playing everything that I see, but I'm trying to get underneath the skin of the music, and yet there's also something about it that's always me too, and not that composer.
Hi, and welcome to The Spark, where we meet the real people behind great works of art. Today on the program, the lovely classical pianist Simona Dinnerstein. So stay tuned, you've got The Spark. This is the amazingly incredible story of the amazingly incredible Simona Dinnerstein. Her father is painter Simon Dinnerstein. Her career as a concert pianist had not taken off. When she found out she was pregnant, she decided to take on a piece of music commonly referred to as Mount Everest, Bach's Goldberg Variations. She then recorded it live in concert herself. She then released it herself. She then found herself playing concerts all over the world. She's a woman of intense passion who has broken every rule and turned the classical world on its ear. Her second CD, The Berlin Concert, is about to be released. I can't listen to it without crying. You should know Simona Dinnerstein. Check it out.
You must have a relationship with the piano that's very intense.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that playing the piano is a very sensual experience. It's very touch-oriented.
Writing in France, and I had this very spare apartment where the bed was pushed up against the back of the piano, and I woke up and I realized that I had started sleeping like right next to the piano, and I'd wake up with my hand on the back of it, you know, it's almost as if it were, you know, my significant other.
Right.
And I thought, oh, that's so true.
Well, my husband claims that I play the piano on him at night when I'm asleep.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
And actually, it was really funny because I was traveling the other day when I was going back home from London. I was traveling with a friend of mine, a composer, and he said, you know what? You were sleeping and you were playing the piano.
Oh, my gosh.
So I guess I do play in my sleep.
How many hours a day do you play usually?
It depends on, you know, how much time I have. If I have the time, I do, like, you know, between 6 and 8 hours.
That's amazing. Is that normal for a classical musician?
Pretty normal, yeah. I think pianists tend to practice.
You've just made all rock musicians look really bad. your story is so incredible. I was wondering if you ever felt like giving up along the way.
I didn't feel like giving up, but I did have times when I felt extremely low.
Yeah.
And I did think that I had to change my whole attitude about what I was aiming for, because I felt that I was, you know, for many years what I wanted was to have like a very traditional concert career where I would be a soloist, an international soloist, and play, you know, with big orchestras and all of that.
But now you are doing that.
Now I am doing that, but I didn't, at a certain point it became clear that that was not what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I felt that I was always going to have to be a musician, and I knew that I always had to be, that was who I was. So I had to adjust what it was that meant and feel happy doing smaller things, playing collaboratively, you know, being, you know, maybe a little more in the background, but always, you know, making my living by being a musician.
Right.
And that was really hard for me to get to adjust to that point, but I really felt it was important because I didn't want to feel like I was, you know, bitter and whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was after I started to really be okay with that idea of changing my feelings about what it meant to be a musician that then I thought, well, I'll learn the Goldberg variations, and then I thought I'll make this recording, but it was really more for myself, you know, it was more for, you know, that this was a project that I would like to do, because I thought it was a really great thing to do, and I thought I would do it well, and it wasn't about what's happened now. I mean, I had no idea that mm-hmm. this is what was going to happen. I just...
Do you feel like that contributed to your success in some
way? I feel like it did, actually. If anybody had said to me, if I asked anybody, what do you think about me recording the Goldberg variations, everyone would have said this is a totally impractical thing to do. You know, it doesn't make any sense to record this piece because, or even to perform it, because it has such a kind of history and there's so much baggage with that piece of music. But I think that the thing was that I felt that this was something that I wanted to do because it was what I needed to do. You know, I felt like it was what I was ready to play this piece. I was, it was for artistic reasons that I chose to do this. And I think that that's the thing. It was, I kind of stopped thinking about,
practical.
Like, you know, I tended to play music in the past that I thought people wanted to hear. And it wasn't necessarily the music that I was the best at playing. But I was kind of trying to think of what would be successful. Yeah. You know? And this was something that I just felt I wanted to play. I knew I could, you know, I knew it was what I was supposed to play then.
Mm-hmm.
And despite people saying it didn't make any sense to do it.
But you didn't think about, when you were going to learn it, you didn't think, oh, I'm going to make a record of it.
No, I just wanted to learn it first. It was actually for a particular recital. I learned it for my debut recital in Philadelphia.
But you were pregnant when you were learning it?
Yes. I decided to learn it right after I found out I was pregnant. And then I learned it while I was pregnant and started playing it, performing it after Adrian was born.
So, it's always hard to talk about the big, majestic things, but it sounds like it really was. I read in one article that you were only eating certain things, and that you were, and I wasn't sure what. At first, I was like, I wonder if that's because she was pregnant, and then, but there's this physical sense of what you know, the practice that you are doing 8 hours a day too, and I wondered. I'm sure it was all a part of whatever you were going through.
Well, the eating special things was when I recorded it, which was a few years after he was born.
Oh, really?
He was born in...
Tell me!
He was born in 2001, and I started performing it in 2002, and I recorded it in 2005. And when I was preparing for the recording sessions, I started doing yoga very intensively. Mm-hmm. And I started eating, you know, very healthily, you know, like only whole grains and all that kind of thing, you know. And my husband, who is incredibly supportive, when during the 3 days of recording, he actually packed my food for me that I brought up so that I would have all of the right foods at the recording session. So I had like all these fresh fruits and yogurts and things like that. And I had my yoga that I would do in the breaks.
Last night when I was watching you play, there was a moment right before you began the concert where you gathered yourself and you just were really quiet.
Mm.
And I felt really bad that I was really wanting to take the rock club on for you and just kill them for every clinking glass and every cell phone and every time the door opened. But what were you thinking in that, or not thinking?
Well, I feel like before I start to play a concert, I need to just kind of gather myself, you know, and be quiet. Mm-hmm. Make sure I'm breathing, and just get. And I think it also, if I take that time, everybody else settles down too. You know, I think that the audience is, it's hard for an audience to just become still.
Yeah.
And especially before starting to play the Goldberg Variations, it needs to have a lot of quiet. So mm-hmm. I always take a little bit of time and just...
Are you telling yourself anything or just erasing?
No, just trying to clear everything.
That's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
There's such an intensity when you're up there by yourself, where it's you, the piano, the composer, and the piece.
Mm.
And I thought, oh my gosh, that there, you know, and very subtly all four of those things are speaking at once.
Mm.
You know, I at some point boil a lot down to telling a story. Does that ever come into your thinking at all?
Wait, you're saying that about singing a song?
Yeah. Or writing, or
right,
a melody even.
I think that's different. I think if I was a composer, then maybe that would be something that I think about.
Well, you're a really good storyteller for something just to think about it. How is your touring schedule?
It's pretty crazy.
No, I know it's crazy. I looked at it. Yeah. But I mean, how does it... I find that touring makes it really hard to be a good musician. You know, sometimes it's like a lovely thing. And I play a beautiful city in Europe, or you know, San Francisco, or something like that. And other times I'm exhausted. I tour in a van or a bus, you know, and like physically, I'm kind of at the edge of what I can do. And I haven't practiced. And I think that's when things become rote.
I've been noticing that I feel really tired while I'm performing if I'm traveling too much, and I don't like that feeling at all. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard, especially if I'm performing something like the Goldberg Variations, which needs so much focus and concentration for a really prolonged period of time. You need to be really not tired when you're doing it. The biggest problem is that I really, really miss my husband and son, and I find it really horrible and increasingly more and more painful to have to say goodbye. You know, for all of us, it's just really hard. And my son is getting to the age now, because he's 6 and a half, where he can articulate to me that he's feeling bad about me going, you know. And it's great that he's telling me that he feels this way, but it's also, you know, really hard if he says something. Like, he said something to me about... he'd been misbehaving, which is unusual for him, and he'd really been acting out. And it was right before I was going away, like the week going up. And I finally said, "Why are you doing this? You've been really saying all these mean things, whatever." And he said, "Whenever I think about you going away, I get a choking feeling in my throat. And then I say the wrong thing." And I was just about to leave the next day, you know.
Oh, my God.
So that was really pretty horrible. So, you know, this is kind of happening more and more. And, I mean, just the feeling of that, you know, you just think, well, why am I going away? But the other thing that I noticed, too, like this trip I just had, I was away for a week in London, and I went also to France when I was there. And I was thinking about it, it's that every day when you're away is much longer than the day that you would be spending, the equivalent day that you'd be spending at home.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is packed into those
two weeks,
you know.
Is scheduled, I'm sure.
Right, and so it feels like I've been away forever. And then I get home, and it's like, it's almost like one of those sort of time warp things where for Jeremy and Adrian, their week was a regular week, you know, and it had regular time. But my week was like the equivalent of like four of those weeks. And so, and you know, then there's a transition from me being pretty much the center of attention wherever I went, you know.
It's horrible. Everybody's really nice to you, and they tell you how great you are. Or they don't.
But I mean, at least, you know, they're paying attention in some kind of way. And then you get home, and it's like, you know, I mean, my husband doesn't make any... He's very supportive, but I have to get up at 6:45 the next morning to make breakfast for everyone, and you know, there's no lying in. I mean, one thing I've noticed from the other musicians that I have come across is that a lot of musicians are really hard to deal with because they are used to being the center of attention or having people run around and do things for them, you know, and they don't know how to take care of themselves or sort of be considerate of other people or, you know, just do normal things normally. And I think because I didn't have an early success and also I have a normal life with my husband and son,
you're a very nice person to begin with.
Well, you could argue with my husband about that one.
I will.
But in any case, the fact is that I do have a normal life too, and even though it's hard to adjust constantly between those two things, I think it's good that I have that,
because absolutely.
Otherwise, you could really get completely warped.
I definitely wanted to ask you about teachers. I've had great mentors along the way, but it's kind of this make it up as you go thing, and I know that. That's true for what you do too, but...
Well, I feel like I had three major teachers. I had Solomon Mikofsky when I was growing up, like from when I was 9 to when I graduated high school. And I think that he gave me a foundation for my playing, you know, a physical foundation, but also a real aesthetic, a real sense of sound that he was going for. And also, he really let me be very free and expressive in my playing. When I was really young, I tended to be a little over the top in how I played. Like, I was really emotive. You know, like, schmaltzy.
I think that can be said for most of us, don't you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, but I think that a lot of teachers, classical piano teachers, actually try to get rid of that from the students, you know. They want to make them play with a certain kind of taste. And he let me do that, and I'm really grateful to him that he let me be that expressive. And then I studied with Maria Curcio, who in London, and she was amazing because she had this link to an old tradition. She'd studied with Arthur Schnabel, who was one of my heroes, and she had this sound world that came from a different era, you know, from the 1930s, you know.
Right.
And she also kind of rebuilt my technique and talked about technique and the music and the technique being one thing together. And that was really an amazing thing to learn. And I feel like she really gave
me so much.
Like,
music is technique?
Yeah, like, for a lot of classical musicians think that technique is facility, like moving your fingers fast. And then musicality is being expressive.
Right.
But what she said is that your technique technique means the skills to make the music come to life.
To make the music sing.
Right. So you need to be able to have the technique to... You need facility, but that's only one aspect of technique. There's sound, there's color, there's touch, there's... and all of those things aren't separated from musicality.
She unified your vision in a lot of ways.
But I had to learn an awful lot of technique from her to do that, you know? And then I studied with Peter Serkin at Juilliard, and he was really intellectual and very inquisitive and creative and kind of idiosyncratic, really. And I think that he opened up another world to me of the possibilities of how to interpret music, you know, because he didn't feel, he wasn't afraid to do things that were really unusual. And that was a real eye-opener. There were colors, there were sounds that he was going for in the piano that were unlike anything else I'd ever heard. And they sounded odd. They were almost unpianistic. Mm-hmm. But that didn't bother him. He mm-hmm. had an idea in his head of a sound, and he would just go for that sound. And I think also he didn't have the answers. Often the lesson would be, I would play, and then there'd be like a silence for a little while he thought about what I'd just done. And then he would ask me questions about why I had done certain things.
That's so fascinating. You know?
Yeah, and I just felt like that was pretty amazing that he didn't say, well, this is how this should go.
If I were your student, uh-huh. and I wanted to start getting to know classical music better, where would you send me first?
Well, that's a complicated question.
I knew it.
I mean, I used to have, when I was teaching, I would have my students listen to all sorts of music. And I always have encouraged pianists not to listen to piano music. The piano mimics many, many other instruments. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to be a really great pianist, you need to hear all of those other sounds so that you can try to recreate those sounds.
That's
on the piano.
So
I'd probably have you listen to a lot of Bach.
Okay, I'll start there. Your playing and your story, you strike me as someone who's very brave. And I was wondering where you get your courage from.
I don't know, really, because I feel normally extremely vulnerable, and
that's what makes you know. You don't have courage without fear.
And I'm very sensitive, and I tend to easily cry at anything, you know. But I think when it comes right down to it, I'm very tough underneath it all. But there are many things that push my buttons and make me upset. When I went through that whole process with trying to find a label for the CD, it was excruciating because I believed in the CD and I thought it should be on a label, mm-hmm. but plenty of people didn't want to do it, you mm-hmm. know, and it was really painful to get rejection after rejection. Sure. But I think that somehow or other I have some kind of core belief in myself, which I've really only realized about in the past few years. I mean, I think I probably had it the whole time, but I didn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I certainly have a lot of self-doubt. I think it's important to question everything that you do all the mm-hmm. time. But I think that at the same time, if you don't believe in yourself, there's really no point in doing it. You know, I mean, why subject a whole audience to what you're doing if you...
No, absolutely. What do you think that we can really know about you from listening to your work?
I mean, I think that I feel that the way that I play, that when I play, that's the most me. I don't feel when I'm talking that's the most me, you know. And I don't feel I can really articulate what it is that I feel about things when I talk.
You have to do it through play.
Yeah.
Well, that answers my question pretty well.